KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Multiple judges found President Trump cannot end birthright citizenship, but the administration found an argument that challenged the Supreme Court, a bid to limit the power of judges. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has been conducting traffic stops in Nashville. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And Amy Martinez, Nashville's mayor, wants answers as to who's been arrested, and he's speaking out about it. Also, Mark Twain said patriotism is supporting your country all the time and your government only when it deserves it. Now, a new biography explores the life of the literary great. It's Friday, May 16th. Happy birthday to Argentinian tennis star and the winner of the 1990 U.S. Open, Gabriela Sabatini, is 55 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. It's been a destructive week in Gaza. The Gaza Health Ministry says Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 300 Palestinians in the past 3 days. Israel says it's pressuring Hamas to release hostages. This comes as President Trump wraps up his trip to the Mideast today. NPR's Hadil Alshelchi has more.
Israel's military has dramatically intensified its campaign in Gaza, with President Trump still in the region. That's the sound of a few of the strikes overnight in the north of Gaza. Israeli officials say the intense bombing is their final warning to Hamas. Surrender, or they will launch an expanded offensive in Gaza. In preparation for it, dubbed Gideon's Chariot, Israel has been calling up tens of thousands of reservists. The plan involves displacing a large number of Palestinians to the south. There were hopes President Trump would advance talks towards a ceasefire during his trip to the Middle East, but there has been no public announcement about the talks. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Direct talks between Ukrainian and Russian delegations have concluded in Turkey. They only lasted a couple of hours. Russian President Vladimir Putin had called for the talks last weekend. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky went to Turkey yesterday, saying he was ready to meet Putin himself. But Putin didn't go. He sent a low-level delegation instead. President Trump had hinted he might go to the talks, but he did not. Trump said today nothing will happen to end Russia's war in Ukraine until he and Putin personally meet. A closely watched barometer of the U.S. economy has dropped. The University of Michigan's consumer sentiment gauge fell this month for the fifth month in a row. Since January, it's fallen by nearly a third. Americans are taking a dim view of the U.S. economy following the imposition of President Trump's global tariffs. Pools in the mountain ranges supplying water to the Colorado River are far lower than normal for this time of year, but this may not be receiving as much attention as usual. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports there's disarray in federal offices that manage water for 40 million people across the West.
Look at maps of snow totals across the Rockies right now, and you'll see a whole lot of red. Eric Balkin is with the nonprofit Glen Canyon Institute.
I think some of that chaos within the agencies, the broader negotiations happening on the Colorado River, all of these other factors, I think, are sort of drowning out the severity of the drought situation right now.
Low snow totals now could spell catastrophe for Lake Powell as soon as next year. The nation's second largest reservoir could lose the ability to generate hydropower or even send water downstream to the millions of people who depend on it. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Engineers who drive New Jersey Transit's commuter trains are on strike over wages. Hundreds of thousands of commuters are without transportation. New Jersey officials say they're seeking a fair contract agreement. It's NPR. A federal judge is scheduled to hold the latest hearing today in the case of the migrant illegally deported from Maryland to El Salvador. U.S. District Judge Paula Zinnes will hear Trump administration arguments about why the administration can keep information secret in the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. The U.S. Supreme Court has told the Trump administration to facilitate his return. Authorities in Fresno County, California are calling it a miraculous story of survival. A 28-year-old Georgia woman missing for 3 weeks was found alive this week in a snow-packed section of the Sierra National Forest. And here's Amy Held reports.
You don't see stories like this.
Tony Boddy, spokesman for the Fresno County Sheriff's Department, says search crews were prepared for the worst.
It speaks to the tenacity Tiffany has.
Tiffany Slayton went missing on a solo camping trip. A blizzard hit. Then on Wednesday, Christopher Gutierrez, owner of a remote resort closed for the season, was checking the boathouse for bears.
Here comes Tiffany. She pops out, just ran up, and all she wanted was a hug.
Gutierrez leaves cabins open in case of stranded hikers like Tiffany, who said she survived on wild leeks.
All she wanted was a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
And to make an important phone call.
She said, "Dad, I'm alive and I'm sorry."
Bobby Slayton says he hadn't heard his daughter's voice since April 18th. Amy Held, NPR News.
Tomorrow is the grand finale of this year's Eurovision Song Contest in Switzerland. It launched the careers of groups like ABBA. Competitors will perform tomorrow, and then the audience votes. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Judging by their questions in oral arguments, the Supreme Court seemed divided yesterday.
Yeah, they went back and forth with lawyers for more than 2 hours about birthright citizenship. Lower courts have found it was unconstitutional for President Trump to try and erase that constitutional right by executive order.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg says the government advanced a different argument. Hi there, Nina.
Hi there, Steve.
So, Nina, what was the president trying to do, or his lawyers, anyway?
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously 127 years ago that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was enacted after the Civil War, says unambiguously that all babies born in the United States are automatically U.S. citizens. President Trump, however, has always had his own interpretation. So on his first day in office this year, he issued an executive order declaring that the children of parents who entered the U.S. illegally or on a temporary visa are not entitled to automatic U.S. citizenship. Three different district court judges ruled that the executive order violated the Constitution. In addition, they issued temporary nationwide orders called universal injunctions that temporarily barred the enforcement of the Trump order anywhere in the country while the case is litigated in the appeals courts. The Trump administration, claiming that the judges had exceeded their authority, then went to the Supreme Court asking it to block those nationwide injunctions.
Yeah, I guess the argument is that the ruling in a lower court should only apply to the case that's in front of them. And in fairness, some justices do not seem to have liked nationwide injunctions in the past.
Correct. But yesterday, they didn't seem so certain, especially after Trump's Solicitor General, John Sauer, reiterated the president's view that the 14th Amendment only applies to former slaves and their children. Justice Sotomayor asked whether, if a new president ordered the military to confiscate all guns in the country, would the courts have to sit back and wait until every person whose gun is taken files a lawsuit? Justice Kagan then followed up asking Sauer about Trump's birthright executive order known as an EO.
Let's just assume you're dead wrong. How do we get to single rule of citizenship that is not the rule that we've historically applied rather than the rule that the EO would have us do?
Later, when Solicitor General Sauer hedged on whether the administration is committed to abiding by any court ruling, Justice Barrett leaned forward in her chair, asking him whether the administration would abide by appeals court orders. Sauer responded this way.
There are circumstances when it is not a categorical practice.
Interesting that he is questioned there by a Trump appointee. He says, maybe we would follow appeals court orders, maybe not. How did the justices respond to that?
I don't think that answer went down very well. Here's Justice Kavanaugh, for instance, asking a series of practical questions.
What do hospitals do with a newborn? What do states do with a newborn?
The federal officials will have to figure that out.
Replied Sauer, we just don't know. Justice Jackson then interjected.
Your argument seems to turn our justice system into a catch-me-if-you-can kind of regime where everybody has to have a lawyer and file a lawsuit in order for the government to stop violating people's rights.
When Sauer suggested that litigants could bring class actions instead of individual lawsuits, lawyer Jeremy Feigenbaum, representing the state, said that would produce, quote, unprecedented chaos on the ground.
Nina, sometimes you can listen to the justices' questions and predict how they're going to rule. Are you able to predict this time?
Nope.
We'll just have to keep listening then. NPR's Nina Totenberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, this is all complicated and consequential and also kind of cool. So we've brought in Amy Howe of SCOTUS blog, who was also listening to the arguments of the Supreme Court yesterday. She's come by with, well, you got a big tall drink there. What do you got there?
I have a Duchess Earl Grey tea.
Okay, excellent. Well, welcome. Welcome. I'm glad you're well lubricated or whatever the word is.
You've caffeinated,
got caffeinated. You've got tea. What do you make of the administration's focus on universal injunctions?
You know, this is something that has been, as Solicitor General John Sauer said yesterday at the oral argument, sort of a bipartisan bane. You know, the Department of Justice, the Biden administration, before that the Obama administration, both Trump administrations feel like they have been stymied in their ability to implement some of their major policy initiatives by these universal injunctions. You know, that somebody who opposed one of these policy injunctions could go to a federal court during the Trump administration. It would be a federal court, as Justice Elena Kagan said yesterday, in somewhere like San Francisco or Seattle, during the Biden administration in Texas, and go quickly and get a ruling from a federal judge that would block the administration from implementing that policy or that regulation anywhere in the country. And so this is something that has been happening, particularly during the early stages of this Trump administration, in no small part because the president has been issuing so many executive orders. But as General Sauer said yesterday, it's something that is bipartisan.
Okay, so I'm thinking of the old saying about lawyers, if the facts are on your side, argue the facts. If the law is on your side, argue the law. And I'm wondering if in this case, if the law is not on your side, you argue a technicality. Did they go for this universal injunction thing because they knew they'd be likely to lose on the actual question of whether it's constitutional to deny birthright citizenship?
I do think that is exactly what's going on. And indeed, you know, several of the justices have expressed frustration with the universal injunctions in recent years in some of their written opinions. And the Biden administration Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar came to the Supreme Court towards the end of the Biden administration, also trying to get the Supreme Court to weigh in on universal injunctions. At that point, the Supreme Court turned her down. And so the Trump administration came, and it came only on this issue of universal injunction said, you know, we're not, this is not about birthright citizenship, but, you know, birthright citizenship, there were no justices yesterday who, despite General Sauer's insistence that the executive order is constitutional, were speaking out in defense of the order. You know, everyone seemed to think that who spoke up about it seemed to think that it was wrong on the merits, and it was really difficult to sort of talk about the two separately.
I want to understand the way the administration might apply a ruling in their favor. If we find out that a judge in San Francisco, Seattle, wherever it is, they make a ruling, they find something is unconstitutional, and it only applies to that one person, and the administration is trying to deny the citizenship of 10,000 people, say, and one person sues, and we find out that it's unconstitutional, as it seems always to have been. Did you understand the administration to say their intent in that case would be to go ahead and deny citizenship to the other 9,999 people?
They weren't saying that they wouldn't. And so that seemed to trouble Justice Amy Coney Barrett, one of Trump's appointees during his first term. And I think sort of layered on top of that is sort of a general skepticism right now of the Trump administration in light of some of its conduct in some of the other cases that have come to the Supreme Court, and in particular the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland man who was sent to El Salvador, is still in a prison in El Salvador due to what the Trump administration admits was an administrative error. And so the Trump administration Supreme Court ordered the Trump administration to facilitate his return. It has not yet happened.
This is really interesting. So there's two questions here. One is the constitutionality of denying birthright citizenship. One is the matter of universal injunctions. Did it sound to you like the justices really had a third question on their minds? Like, is this administration going to listen to us less and less over time?
It did sound like that. And I think that was part of the problem. You know, generally, you know, if they were to get rid of universal injunctions, you know, requiring someone to litigate these issues piecemeal, you know, would not be the problem, perhaps, that the justices might think it would be now with this administration.
Amy Howe is with SCOTUS Blog. Thanks for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Florida is now the second state in the country after Utah to ban putting fluoride in all public waters. Tristan Wood of member station WFSU reports.
Fluoride is a mineral used to fight cavities. It was first used in municipal waterways in America in 1945. Recently, politicians have been pointing to a mix of fluoride studies to push for banning the practice. One of those politicians is Florida Surgeon General Joseph Latipo. He says banning fluoridation is the right move.
It's okay to reverse your position when there's evidence. I mean, that's the right thing to do. You're in a position of leadership. You're there to serve people.
The evidence he's pointing to is research published in JAMA Pediatrics, which looked at several studies outside of the U.S. It suggests a link between high levels of fluoride and a small decrease in children's IQ. The amount of fluoride exposure researched in those studies was much higher than what is added to public waters in the U.S. During the bill signing Thursday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said public fluoridation robs people of medical choices.
Yes, use fluoride for your teeth, that's fine, but forcing it into the water supply is basically forced medication on people. They don't have a choice. You're taking that away from them.
Several groups, including the Florida Dental Association, are critical of the move. Low levels of fluoride, as used in drinking water in the U.S., is generally considered safe and a key part of dental health. The association's president, Jeff Otley, worries about negative oral health impacts on people across Florida. He's particularly concerned about poor children on Medicaid because not enough dentists accept it.
They're going to have an increase in the number of cavities, increase in the severity of cavities, and then because we have such a shortage of Medicaid providing dentists, they're going to be unable to find providers to help take care of those problems.
The Florida fluoride ban goes into effect July 1st. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood in Tallahassee.
This is NPR News.
The Zombies, the British band whose hits were She's Not There, Tell Her No, and Time of the Season, is the subject of a new documentary. On the next Fresh Air, our interview with lead singer Colin Blundstone. Also, we remember director James Foley, whose films included At Close Range and Glengarry Glen Ross. Join us. Let me try with pleasured hands
to take you in the sun. Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. John D. Rockefeller, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Ulysses S. Grant. Those are just some of the consequential American figures that Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Ron Chernow has captured in his detailed and exhaustively researched biographies. Now he turns his eye to Mark Twain, arguably America's most famous writer, but also, as Chernow writes, the country's foremost talker and a hugely complicated, exasperating, and in some ways tragic man. Ron Chernow is with us now to talk more about Mark Twain. Welcome back. Thank you so much for talking with us once again.
So lovely to be here with you, Michelle. Thank you.
Why him? Did you feel like something needed to be corrected or was missing?
Well, this is kind of, I think, the great epic story in American letters. Mark Twain was the largest personality that American literature has produced, and it was really an ideal story because this story has an unusual amount of literary triumph and personal tragedy. It has all the light and shadow that one could possibly want in a biography.
So tell us about his early life. I mean, a lot of us know the basics. He was born Samuel Clemens. He was born in Missouri. You know, I was struck by how sad it was. Like, it just seemed like a really kind of sad and lonely upbringing.
Yeah, his father fails at one business after another. He said of his relationship with his father that it amounted to a sort of armed neutrality and that it was a little more than an introduction. But his older brother, Orion, was appointed secretary of the Nevada Territory, and so he brought young Sam along. Sam had first tried his hand at mining. He didn't make a penny, but then he started contributing articles to a newspaper called the Territorial Enterprise, and they hired him as a city editor. And he said his first day on the job, he was terrified. He didn't have anything to write, and he said, Then a desperado killed the man in a saloon, and joy returned once more.
Oh, my goodness.
he had found his métier. And then in his early articles in this Nevada newspaper, he created a lot of hoaxes and tall tales. He became a very popular but also very controversial figure, and then wound up in San Francisco, where a more serious literary career began.
You know, he was born into a slave-owning family.
Yeah.
You write that no other white American in the 19th century engaged so fully with the black community. I mean, you said, look, he reinvented himself as a Northeastern liberal, at times even a radical, but you also point out that there are a number of very important issues relating to the treatment of black Americans that he didn't write about at all.
Yeah, okay. I mean, this is kind of a big part of the book. He is born into a slave-owning family in a slave-owning state. He said that when he was growing up in Hannibal, Missouri, slavery was not only accepted, it was sanctioned by the church. He said it was considered, you know, God's pet project. And when he's a teenager, Michelle, he has all of the kind of crude racist attitudes that you would expect from someone, you know, who grew up in that environment. He then marries into an abolitionist family, the Langdons, in upstate New York, and gets to know Frederick Douglass and Wendell Phillips and other abolitionists. And his views begin to change quite radically, to the point where, you know, in writing Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, it's arguably the greatest anti-slavery novel in the language. But his growth on this issue was so extraordinary. He said, for instance, that the birth of American liberty, when it's not 1776, but 1865, the year slavery was outlawed. He sarcastically said that the Declaration of Independence should have said that white men are created equal. Mm-hmm. And he even fully paid for the education of two black students. He never becomes a perfect human being, but his growth from his, you know, racist beginnings really is a great story that I tried to reconstruct in very fine detail.
But you also point out how he was capable of these big thoughts, of really profound consideration of this great stain on the American story. And yet he still felt he was such a sucker when it came to his business dealings. And he's always picking fights with people. That's the other thing that you point out, is that he collected grudges as if they were money. Like, what's up with that?
Well, it was interesting, you know, because our image of Mark Twain, which has some truth to it, is of, you know, a man in a white suit smoking a cigar, a man who's dispensing witticisms, and he's very charming and genial and funny. And that was true. But beneath kind of the stereotype, he could be very, very moody and temperamental. Mark Twain did not get past things. He would tend to brood on wrongs for months or years. He was lucky that he was married to a wonderful woman, Livy Langdon, who had to help him with what we would today call anger management. She trained him, for instance, when he sat down and wrote a very angry letter at someone, to stash the letter in the drawer and then write another one when he had cooled down a bit.
Is there something that you hope that people will get from this book that perhaps they haven't seen before or thought about when they think about him?
Well, I think that, you know, Mark Twain, we tend to think of Mark Twain as the quintessential American. I was surprised to find in his notebook he wrote a line, "I am not an American, I am the American." Now, that sounds rather arrogant, but I think that it's probably true. And I kept feeling as I was writing this book that Mark Twain condensed in one life, in one person, both the best and the worst of our national character. And I also felt, Michelle, that he was kind of very important for today. Mark Twain had very valuable things to say on patriotism. It drove him crazy when people would say, "My country, right or wrong." He said, "We should support our country always, but our government only when it deserves it." He had wonderful things to say about the press. He said, "Irreverence is the champion of liberty and its surest guarantee." And he also warned us about the dangers of hyper-partisanship. He made the statement that if the Democrats put the multiplication table in their platform, the Republicans would vote it down at the next election. Doesn't that sound familiar? You know, so I think that he continues across the span of 100 years to talk to us about all sorts of issues that remain relevant in American life today.
That's Ron Chernow. His new book is Mark Twain. Ron Chernow, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Always a pleasure, Michelle. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
25 years after the premiere of the hugely popular film Final Destination, the franchise is back for a sixth installment. And the makers of the movie say it's going to be more gory and terrifying than ever.
The death that comes for you in Final Destination is really death by filmmaking.
I'm Ilsa Chang. More from the team behind Final Destination Bloodlines on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Russian President Vladimir Putin was absent from what would have been his first direct talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. President Trump shared his thoughts about Putin.
He and I will meet. I think we'll solve it, or maybe not, but at least we'll know. And if we don't solve it, it'll be very interesting.
Trump speaking to reporters on Air Force One on his return home from the Middle East. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says European leaders and Trump are coordinating a response after agreeing that Russia's stance on ceasefire talks with Ukraine is unacceptable. 450 locomotive engineers across New Jersey are on strike for higher pay. They walked off the job overnight and shut down the New Jersey Transit's rail system. Tom Haas, a general chairman for the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, defended the statewide strike, the first of its kind in more than 40 years.
This is not something that we undertake lightly. We completely understand the impact that a strike can and will have on all the commuters of New Jersey. But ultimately, let's be clear, this rests at the feet of New Jersey Transit.
The strike is expected to affect more than 300,000 daily commuters in the New York metropolitan area. U.S. stocks trading higher with the Dow up 42 points. This is NPR News. In a first for a Broadway play, CNN plans to air Good Night and Good Luck, the stage hit starring and co-authored by George Clooney. Jeff London reports the unprecedented live broadcast is scheduled June 7th, the night before the Tony Awards.
George Clooney's vehicle about journalist Edward R. Murrow taking on Senator Joseph McCarthy has been a Broadway juggernaut. It's recouped its $9.5 million investment and has been breaking box office records for a play every week.
There are a certain kind of people wired a certain kind of way. You know there's a story behind the story if you're bold enough to search for it.
Now, subscribers to basic cable will be able to see it without paying premium ticket prices on June 7th, the night before the show closes. After the broadcast, CNN will host a special looking at the state of global journalism in context of the production. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
A British court has denied bail to R&B singer Chris Brown, throwing next month's scheduled launch of the Grammy-winning artist's world tour in doubt. Brown is charged with assaulting a music producer at a London nightclub more than 2 years ago. Prosecutors say the attack was unprovoked. The Dow's up 28 points, S&P's climbed 9, the Nasdaq up 17. This is NPR News. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Martinez. Immigration agents have been active in cities across the country, arresting and detaining people. It's part of an effort by the Trump administration to ramp up deportation. Now, in Nashville, Tennessee, local officials are pushing back, and that's left the city and its mayor pitted against federal officials. From member station WPLN, here's Cynthia Abrams.
Earlier this month, ICE agents, working with state police, began making a series of traffic stops in a Latino neighborhood in Nashville. The Department of Homeland Security says nearly 200 arrests have been made so far, and about half of the people detained have prior criminal convictions. The arrests prompted an immediate reaction from the community. Here's Zagnita Vargas with Remix Tennessee, an immigrant support group.
The goal here is not safety, it is fear. Businesses in the area are suffering, trust in government agencies is declining, and all of us, regardless of our immigration status, should be alarmed.
At a city council meeting, she called on leaders to take action.
What will the council and the mayor commit to concrete policies and procedures to keep immigrant families safe?
Nashville's Democratic Mayor Freddie O'Connell says he is also opposed to the traffic stops.
I want to be clear. We did not request this approach to safety. We do not support it.
But he also says that the city has little power to intervene because only federal authorities can enforce immigration laws. Instead, O'Connell is trying to get the names of all the people arrested during the traffic stops.
There's a strong probability that people have been detained that are here legally that simply did not have documentation with them as they were driving on the streets of Nashville. And so we want to validate that.
In a press release, the Department of Homeland Security criticized the mayor, saying he stands by, quote, pro-illegal policies. DHS says its actions are about protecting Americans from criminal illegal aliens. But the mayor disagrees.
These raids aren't about safety. In Nashville right now, violent crime is down. Property crime is down.
Even one of the council's most conservative members, Republican Courtney Johnston, has criticized the ICE action, blaming both parties for failing to fix the nation's broken immigration system over decades. She said on Facebook she fears massive negative impact on the local economy, especially in hospitality and construction. So far, DHS has only identified 5 of the people arrested in the traffic stops, but the names of 191 other people remain unknown. For NPR News, I'm Cynthia Abrams in Nashville.
A Milwaukee judge was in federal court yesterday as a defendant. Judge Hannah Dugan pleaded not guilty to charges that she helped a person without legal status to slip out of her courtroom to evade immigration authorities. She denies any wrongdoing and wants for her case to be thrown out. It is rare for a judge to be prosecuted like this. But as NPR's Tovia Smith reports, a similar case has been unfolding in Massachusetts for years.
Judge Shelley Joseph was so new to the bench in April 2018, she brought her mother and father-in-law to Newton District Court to watch. She said nothing about her cases seemed out of the ordinary that morning, even though it would turn out to be a day that upended her career.
This prosecution is absolutely political. Shelley Joseph is absolutely innocent.
That was defense attorney Thomas Hoops in a scrum of reporters with Joseph, leaving federal court the day she was indicted on conspiracy and obstruction of justice charges, carrying up to 25 years in prison. Federal prosecutors say Joseph purposely prevented immigration officials from apprehending an undocumented immigrant facing drug charges in her court. Joseph declined to talk to NPR about what happened that day, but prosecutors say her personal views motivated her to tell U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE agents, to wait in the court lobby out front so the defendant could slip out the back.
That's down the stairs and then out to the back parking lot.
In the Newton District Courthouse, a clerk points to the secure back door where that defendant was allowed to exit.
So the public can't go out that door?
No.
And ICE wouldn't have been allowed to chase him down?
No, absolutely not. It's lockup. So, I don't even like going down there.
The incident immediately caught the eye of federal prosecutors.
The prospect that a judge took it upon herself to frustrate an arrest, that was stunning to us. It's like, who does that?
Nathaniel Mendel, then first assistant U.S. attorney, says unlike Wisconsin prosecutors who pounced on Judge Dugan, arresting her within days, his office didn't bring charges for a year and did so only after it became clear that no state official or ethics board was going to.
The alleged conduct was serious enough that there had to be some accounting for that. We can't do nothing. I mean, if you had a judge walking a January 6th defendant out the back of the courtroom, I don't think people would spend a lot of time trying to figure out if that was a good idea or if that was upholding the rule of law or not.
Judge Joseph was removed from the bench, but the case took a lucky turn for her after Joe Biden won election in 2020 and the federal criminal charges were dropped. Instead, Joseph would be investigated by Massachusetts Commission on Judicial Conduct. That meant she could return to work, but she could also lose her job again if the commission believes the charges that she engaged in willful and illegal misconduct and then lied about it.
The notion that this was an intentional effort to subvert the federal government is just poppycock.
Former federal judge Nancy Gertner says Joseph may have made rookie mistakes in court that day, perhaps most notably turning off the court recorder, which is against court rules, and doing so while speaking to the defendant's attorney who she's accused of conspiring with. In legal documents, Joseph maintains she knew nothing about any plan to evade ICE. She says that attorney falsely accused her so he could get an immunity deal for himself. To Gertner, the bigger picture is what she sees as a pattern of federal overreach that undermines states' authority and courts' independence and their ability to do their job.
I think that Joseph was the canary in the coal mine because this is a federal government that doesn't understand that there really are two authorities, and the federal government cannot intimidate or commandeer state proceedings to accomplish their will.
ICE and Justice Department officials did not immediately respond to requests for comment. To some, the folks who need to be reined in more than the federal government are any judges who would treat people differently just based on their immigration status. Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors immigration limits.
If judges are offering escape hatches, allowing people who are in the country illegally to be treated differently, then we really are creating a double standard.
Judge Joseph will get her day, not quite in court, but before the Judicial Commission next month. It'll proceed much like a trial, and her fate will ultimately be decided by the justices of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
President Trump's comments about Canada have resulted in a drop in cross-border commerce. We'll hear voices from both sides of the line. That's next time on Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, May Martinez. Like most people, I don't speak dolphin, but scientists at the Sarasota Dolphin Research Program in Florida might one day be able to because they built up a library of dolphin whistles. Those researchers netted some cash for their efforts. The Collar Doolittle Prize for two-way interspecies communication awarded them 100,000 clams. What do the dolphins get? Just more fish to eat, I would assume. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Eight times a year, the regional banks in the Federal Reserve System study their local economies and bring back stories of what they're seeing. They publish those stories in a report called the Beige Book. Our colleagues over at The Indicator, Waylon Wong and Robert Smith, talked to the Kansas City Fed recently. Its latest Beige Book included outcomes from the Trump administration's government freezes and spending cuts.
Funding cuts from the USDA were highlighted as particularly impactful regarding services for seniors. Specifically, one pantry reported cutting back the amount of food they can give from 3 to 5 days of shelf-stable food to 2 days of food every 30 days due to funding cuts. Stephen Hallin, you wrote that line, and it's very specific. We always hear about food banks struggling generally, but this is a drop of 5 days worth of food to 2 days worth of food. What happened?
Yeah, so the USDA cut about $500 million from food banks, and that substantially impacted the amount of food that food banks could provide to their pantries. So this particular food pantry was responding and trying to serve as many people as they can, but it's going to be less food that they can provide to each person.
The Trump administration cut $1 billion from USDA programs that provide fresh food for school lunches and then also this money for food banks. They said the Biden levels of food assistance were unsustainable.
We wanted to hear what food banks in the region were doing to respond, so we called up one that provides food to 27 counties in Missouri and Kansas.
My name is Stephen Davis, and I'm the president and CEO of Harvesters, the Community Food Network.
Now, food banks always need more food. You never call up a food bank and they say, oh, no, we're good. We got everything we need right now. But Stephen Davis says it's especially bad this year.
Food is incredibly expensive. We all know that. All the other costs have gone up. Rent, mortgages, healthcare costs. So your dollars are just not stretching as far. And often where people have to make sacrifices is on the food that they would purchase.
Stephen from Harvesters said they have a lot of different ways of getting food to give away. Everything from cans donated by community members to deals with food manufacturers to use stuff that would have gotten thrown out. The USDA budget cut really hurts because this was money they could have spent on staple foods that might not get donated.
He estimates that this will mean they will lose out on 2.4 million pounds of food.
So you think about 2.4 million pounds of food. We distributed 61 million pounds of food last year, but that's a meaningful amount of the food that we distributed that we could use to serve families that all of a sudden just went away.
And as we saw in the Beige Book, that can mean essentially food rationing, giving out less food to families so they can serve more people.
Now, of course, Harvesters is going back to their donors and volunteers. They're hustling more extra food from manufacturers. But Stephen says he doesn't know what will happen if the money doesn't come back.
Or if the economy gets worse. Remember, it might be scary right now, but the unemployment rate in the U.S. is still low. Who knows what the next Beige Book will bring? Waylon Wong,
Robert Smith, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Martinez. A new study finds that nearly one in four children in America has a parent with a substance use disorder. And the most commonly used substance is alcohol. As NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, healthcare workers can help identify these kids and better support their health needs.
The researchers used data from a long-running federal survey called the National Survey on Drug Use and Health.
It surveys people in households.
Sean McCabe is with the University of Michigan. He says the most recent survey done in 2023 had used the latest criteria for diagnosing substance use disorders.
So we were able to identify people in their households who had a substance use disorder, and that was the adult.
He and his colleagues estimate that nearly 19 million children live with at least one parent with addiction.
I think the close to 19 million was pretty staggering. It makes you realize that, you know, the scope of this issue is vast.
The study, published in JAMA Pediatrics, also found that 12 million of those kids have a parent addicted to alcohol. And over 7 million have a parent whose addiction is moderate or severe, as opposed to mild.
The challenge with it, though, is that over 3/4 of people with substance use disorders do not get treatment.
An addiction poses health risks to the parents and their kids. For example, kids are at a higher risk of certain mental and behavioral health problems in the long run. Dr. Scott Hadland is the chief of adolescent medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital.
When I'm caring for a young person who has a parent with a substance use disorder, I'm making sure that I'm doing a good job asking about and screening for mental health concerns like depression, anxiety, ADHD, all of which we know can be more common in kids of parents with addiction.
He's also vigilant about signs of substance use in these kids. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that pediatricians discuss substance use with families. Hadland says doctors can also help connect parents with treatment.
This study is showing us just how common substance use disorders are among parents and reminding us that it's important for us to be asking families about this.
Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
The composer of the musicals Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, and Annie has died. Charles Strauss spent his last hours at home in New York. He was 96. If you did not know his name, you may well know the music that we will hear from reporter Jeff London.
Charles Strauss was a musical chameleon, says theater historian Lawrence Maslin.
Strauss was a great craftsperson. He adopted and adapted his vocabulary to whatever the needs of the particular genre were.
He could write songs in the style of early rock and roll.
Oh, one last kiss. Oh, give me one last kiss.
Or Depression era New York.
Hey, horrible man. Hey, dapper Dan. You both got your style, but rather you're never fully dressed without a smile.
Or ultra groovy 1970s New York. Strauss was classically trained at the Eastman School of Music and worked with American composer Aaron Copland. He was making a living playing rehearsal piano for Broadway shows when a stage manager who wanted to be a producer approached him, he told me in 2008.
He said to me, "I hear you write music." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "I have an idea for a show about teenagers. Would I be interested?" I said, "Would I?"
The show was Bye Bye Birdie. It opened in 1960, and even though the New York Times gave it a pan, calling it neither fish nor fowl nor musical comedy, it became an enormous hit, winning the Tony for Best Musical. And since then, it's been one of the most performed shows in community theaters and high schools.
It's a wonderful feeling, and I am modest, though not humble or anyway, but I'm a very lucky man.
And he became a very rich man. Though he suffered a string of flops afterwards, Strauss had another Tony Award-winning smash with Applause, a musical version of All About Eve in 1970.
Because you've had a taste of the sound that says love.
Strauss heard even more applause and won a Tony Award for Best Score with Annie, based on the comic strip Little Orphan Annie, in 1977. He said the best-known song from that score, Tomorrow, was written in rehearsal to cover a set change.
She found the dog, and she had to, in 12 seconds, let's say, get back to the orphanage. So we needed a song there.
Andrea McArdle was 12 years old when she starred in Annie.
My favorite thing was to listen to him play his songs. Not every composer is as charming as Charles Strauss is when he plays his music.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face. Brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face.
That's Charles Strauss singing probably his most famous song, Put on a Happy Face, from Bye Bye Birdie. The composer kept working into his 80s on new projects at a time when most creators would have been happy resting on their accomplishments.
I love composing. I love it, you know. And if I'm not composing, if I don't have a new project or something, I'm rather at a loss of what to do.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Terrific daily news. We do our shows. And what does it?
We're listening to a song there where Strauss sings himself about lousy theater reviews, if I understand it correctly.
Doesn't I thought that was you for a second there, Steve. You sound exactly like it.
No. His compositions also include a super famous TV theme to All in the Family. Those were the days.
See, I think I could do the Gene Stapleton part of it.
Go ahead. You got a few seconds. Hit the high note.
Edith, I can't. No, I won't even try. I won't even disrespect their legacy by trying.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Just love.